I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's your chance to sound off in a few minutes. Our digital media guy, Lee Hill, says you all had plenty to say about my commentary this week. Our Back Talk segment is coming up. But first, our Faith Matters conversation. That's where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. Today, we want to talk about Ramadan. The Muslim holy month for this year started this week on the evening of August 10th. Observant Muslims fast from sunup to sundown, abstaining from food and water. The time is spent in spiritual reflection. Now, much is made of the fasting aspect of Ramadan, but we are going to let you in on a little secret. It turns out that Ramadan might be one of the best times of the year for good eating because when sundown comes, the fast is broken, sometimes with sweets prepared especially for this time of year. So we wanted to know more. So we've called Abdullah Fawaz, executive chef of the Mediterranean Bakery and Cafe. That's in Alexandria, Virginia. That's right outside Washington, D.C. And joining us from Dearborn, Michigan, is Abbas Umar, manager of the Al Amir restaurant. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having us.
Do you find it funny that many non-Muslims are so intrigued by how you managed to get through the month? Mr. Fawaz, do you want to answer that? Do you know what I mean? Do you get questions like, how do you handle it?
The best answer will be if you have faith in God and Iman, that will keep you going.
Okay. And Mr. Umar, what about you?
Sleep during the day and wake up at night.
Okay, very well. So we have the practical and we have the transcendent. There you go. We have both. And may I ask, is it difficult working in the restaurant industry when you're abstaining?
Yes, it is, especially when you are fasting and making all these goodies and kinafas with cheese, with cream, all this. But yes, very difficult.
How do you manage not to, you know, sneak a taste?
Well, think about God, other people, you know, the poor people, they might not have all this food we are doing or we are eating here. And just bear your minds with them and hope. Hopefully God will help them and have, like in Pakistan, Afghanistan, you know, with the flood and all this, God with them, you know, that's the best. But for here, I mean, we thank God for all these food around us.
And that was Mr. Fawaz. Okay, Mr. Umar, what about you? How do you manage to stay focused and not sneak a little taste or something?
I mean, I really just try to stay busy. Like you said, I try to keep it as practical as possible.
Okay.
I mean, I know it's a religious month and we're doing it for all the right reasons, but got my eye on the prize and keep chugging along.
I hear you. Are you cranky right about now?
Pardon?
Mr. Umar, are you cranky right about now? You're a little cranky when you're really honest. Are you a little cranky?
Well, I mean, in a normal situation, no, because this month is not only about not eating. It's a lot more. It's just about applying yourself and reaching a new level of humanity and reaching a new level of self-awareness.
If we could talk about food for a minute, and I hate to, you know, add to your burden, but Mr. Fawaz, why don't you start? Are there some special things that people particularly like to enjoy during Ramadan once the fast is broken?
Sure.
Can you tell us about some of the popular items?
Sure. The most popular item in the Middle East, which we do it only for Ramadan during the year, you don't find it, or rarely you find it unless, you know, some people order it special. It's called kataif. Kataif, it's like American pancakes, a little bit thinner. And we stuff that, we fold them, and we stuff them with nuts and some cream. And then we bake them lightly baked, and after that, dip them directly to honey or a thick syrup. Mm-hmm. And then we decorate it with pistachio and serve it. That's the most popular item in Ramadan. And then, of course, there is the kinafa also with cheese or with the cream. That's semolina dough with the shredded dough mixed together. Also, it has a lot of syrup, of course, and decorated with pistachio.
Do non-Muslims come in and during the day and get these items too, or do you close during the day?
Of course.
Yeah,
no. Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course. They do it. I mean, Americans, they love our food. I mean, and especially when Ramadan, when you have something new, oh, what is this? What's that? And you explain it to them. And they eat it, and they love it. There's no question about it.
Are there?
Our clientele at Al Amir is about 60% non-Muslim. So we got a really large clientele base that really we're not really too affected by the Ramadan.
I see. And do the special Ramadan treats, though, Mr. Umar, like Mr. Fawaz was saying, that sometimes the customers who are not Muslim will see that there are special treats on the menu for Ramadan, and they'll ask them.
Oh, yeah, they love it. They love when Ramadan comes around.
And what about, God, I hate to be pedestrian about this, but what about baklava? Is that popular at this time of year, or is that just...
It is the other choice, you know, the other kind of choice. Baklava is like, it's a wild variety of things, you know. It's the same principle as a phyllo dough or a shredded dough filled with different kind of nuts or cream or cheese and different shapes. And that goes all year around, you know. And also in Ramadan, people, they like to do that. The kataif, like I said before, and kinefa, is those two items is the most popular in Ramadan.
And what about any particular fillings that people particularly want at this time of year? Is there any particular version that's more popular than other?
They like the cream filling, which is, we call it kashta. Kashta, it's like when you boil the cream, the milk, and you skim that top, you know, thick layers coming out of the boiling the cream, and that you add all this skimming, and you make it like almost like a little lighter than a cream cheese.
It's really close to ricotta cheese.
Exactly.
I see. Well, can I ask before I let you go on? You're both very generous with your time because I know you're both really busy. Is there something that each of you particularly likes, Mr. Amar?
You know what I really love, and at our restaurant we have it, it's seasonal. It's only for the month of Ramadan. I just eat a simple date, and I drink some date juice, which we call jalab. And then otherwise than that, it's a free-for-all.
Okay. Just the way you kind of like ease into it, huh?
Yeah. You know, because you haven't eaten all day and you have been fasting for 10-plus hours. I don't think chowing down on a hamburger is really good for you, so I just wade into it.
You wade into it with the date juice. I see.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive me, I've never had it. Is it like prune juice?
Is
there a flavor I could compare it to? I've never had it. I've had dates,
well,
but I've never had date juice.
After the break, you send me your address and I'll make you some jalab.
Okay. Well, thank you. Mr. Fawaz, what's your favorite thing to break the fast with?
Usually we go break the fast, either a cup of water and like a piece or two of dates.
Is that a spiritual thing or is that a cultural thing?
No, it's
or is
a spiritual
it a just...
thing. And but
it's spiritual and practical, I guess.
Yes, it is. And on my side, I have a sweet tooth. I go for kataif right after.
You go right there.
Because I make it all day, and then I care for it, so I cannot wait.
I think I'm with Mr. Fawaz. I think I'm kind of a go right there
person. Exactly.
Just get it done.
Let's get it done. Abdullah Fawaz is the executive chef of the Mediterranean Bakery and Cafe in Alexandria, Virginia. And Abbas Umar is manager of the Al Amir restaurant in Dearborn, Michigan. And they were both kind enough to join us their Ramadan secrets with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you very much.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The term gypsy is freighted with meaning. It's often used to refer to the Romani people, though its purpose was originally derogatory. Gypsies since come to refer to anyone or anything that wanders from place to place, and now it's being used to refer to a new breed of beer brewers. NPR's Claire O'Neill met up with one of them, Brian Strumke, and their journey turned into a three-act drama and a five-course meal.
Act 1.
Yes,
it's 7 a.m. in Westminster, Maryland, but Brian Strumke of Stillwater Artisanal Ales has been awake for hours. The Gypsy Brewer is always on the go. In fact, as soon as I pull into the gravel parking lot of Dog Brewing Company, we hit the road.
I like traveling. I like being on the run. It's just a lot more freedom. And I guess freedom is what the whole concept's about, being able to pick different breweries that match up with the beer I want to make.
Strumke is one of about three people in the world who can call himself a Gypsy Brewer. Like an old-world itinerant preacher, he travels from brewery to brewery, from Belgium to Baltimore, spreading the craft beer gospel. He finds breweries that jibe with his thinking, rents out their excess capacity, and uses his own recipes to create limited-edition batches. But one pitfall of this bohemian life is no permanent storage. We're in the car because Strumke had left his secret weapon at home in Baltimore, white sage.
I'm always, like, looking for weird, like, herbs, just exotic spices, just things to make something different. And so I was just going around sniffing different things, and I came across the sage, and I was like, I like sage.
Gypsy brewing is a new model in the beer-making world, but you can't really call it a trend. Julia Hertz of the Brewers Association.
I have heard that term recently from Greg Ehrnert Ingert of Birch and Barley has used it.
Which brings us to Act Two. At Birch and Barley in Washington, D.C., a beer-centric restaurant with an upstairs bar. That's where Ingert is putting Strumke's Gypsy Brews on the map.
What's special is that, first of all, Brian is always trying to think about food when he's brewing. Also, just the idea that Brian doesn't have a brewery himself. Somebody's got to be a hell of a brewer to gain the trust and the admiration of the breweries so that they actually invite them in to brew.
Ingert carries Strumke's beers when he can, on his menu of more than 500 bottled beers and 50 on draft from around the world. He has a refrigeration system of 3 different temperatures and a whole host of proper glassware. Julia Hertz of the Brewers Association says Ingert is one of the most influential people in the beer world right now, and he's only 28.
I love his spin on things. When I talk to him, I encourage him to consider the Cicerone program, and the Cicerone program is kind of the beer world's version of the Wine Sommelier program now.
As if Ingert even needs it. This year, he made it into Food & Wine magazine's list of America's top sommeliers, or wine experts. He's the first person ever to be included for beer. Megan Krigbaum edited that list.
Every year we have these totally obvious winners that come out with these incredible wine lists. And this year we kind of stumbled across Greg. And what he is doing is just so indicative of how big beer has become in the sort of American palate.
Krigbaum had not heard the term gypsy brewing. But for her, the real trend to watch is the pairing of beer with food, which leads to a revolutionary thought.
Maybe the answer isn't always wine when it comes to pairing, that finally people are coming around to this idea that beer has a place on the dining table.
And that's precisely Greg Ingert's cause. I joined him and Strumke at Birch and Barley for our final act, a 5-course dinner menu created around the gypsy beer, which Ingert describes with the vocabulary of an academic.
The kind of gooseberry aroma, the bright citrus, the touch of herb and grass in the nose.
The first course, yellow garden gazpacho with blue crab, celery, apple, and almond. Wash it down with Strumke's cellar door on cask, French oaked and dry hopped. Guys like Ingert and Strumke are serious about beer, and craft brews are a serious business. Just last year, they accounted for almost 7% of domestic beer sales in the land of Bud. Megan Krigbaum says everyone's drinking beer.
At the end of the day, all the sommeliers are drinking beer. And even winemakers, when they finish a day after harvest, they're not reaching for a glass of Cabernet or something. They're having beer. They're having a Pilsner or, you know, something super refreshing and crisp.
Cheers. Claire O'Neill, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
There's nothing like a summer tomato, red and plump and plucked right off the vine, so the juices inside are still slightly warm from the sun. Good stuff. But by the second week of August, even the most ardent tomato aficionados find that they have too much of a good thing if they're growing tomatoes in the backyard or if they can't resist the urge to fill up their baskets when they head to the local farmer's market. So today, we're going to serve up a little advice on what to do with the tower of summer tomatoes so many of us have stacked on kitchen counters or ripening on our windowsills. For help, we've turned to a couple of guys named Frank. Frank Falsinelli and Frank Castronovo own a popular Brooklyn restaurant called Frankie's Spuntino. Along with Peter Meehan, they've just published a new cookbook called The Frankie Spuntino Kitchen Companion and Cooking Manual. Hello, Frank. Hello, Frank. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us. Happy to be here.
I hope this will be a frank conversation.
We'll be frank as we can.
Both of you have worked in all kinds of restaurants. You've worked in sort of high-end, top-dollar, white tablecloth restaurants, the kind of restaurants where people go to celebrate big events and spend a lot of money in doing so. What are you trying to do with this restaurant, with Frankie Spuntino, and with the book?
We wanted to share what we had been brought up with, which is after seeing the best of the best around the world, we realized that what we had growing up, you know, simple Southern Italian, even peasant food, was amazing, and it had everything. The nutrition, the flavor, the freshness, the simplicity, the love, it was all in there. And we took the lessons that we learned and the experience that we had, and we applied it to grandma's food.
And you say grandma never broke a sweat, neither should you.
Yeah, and if you could imagine, you know, doing that with the restaurant, the idea with the book was really to have a guide for people to get that grandma flavor in their home, you know, any time for their family or their friends or their loved ones. And to be able to, you know, have those go-to recipes that really work, you know, if I want to make the bruschetta, the tomato sauce, if I want to live like an Italian, or if I want to redux my Italian recipes, and then not to be like the gimmicky Italian red sauce thing, like, hey, I'm going to cook some Italian today. You know, it's, these are really serious recipes that work. You know, we serve thousands of people a week that love the food, that come back for it. And from the book, you can recreate it at home, and you can realize how good it is and how inexpensive it is at home.
So, Frank Falsinelli, is this a season of opportunity or a season of responsibility for you when you've got all these tomatoes?
It's the opportunity. You really want to just eat it all. It's like picking the money tree. You want to eat as much tomatoes, but you also realize that you can't eat them all. So you need to start canning them or jarring them, as we do in our case. Frank Castronova was big on, you know, towards the end of the summer, leading the brigade and getting everybody psyched up to work with hot water and jars for a couple of days, get them put up for the winter.
Yeah, they taste good all year long. It's like a little reminder of what that day was like in August and when it was hot and how beautiful it was.
So let me ask you what people who have all these tomatoes could do if they want to prepare dishes for the here and now. And maybe we could go through a day. Let's start with tomatoes for breakfast. Frank Falsinelli, what should we do if we want to tick through some of those tomatoes at the breakfast table?
I like actually putting sugar and pepper on tomatoes if I'm going to eat them before 10 o'clock. So I'll sprinkle it with a little bit of sugar, a little bit of honey, a little drizzle, and then a crack of pepper or some crushed red pepper. So it doesn't feel like you're eating something that's
savory
in the wrong time period, like what happens when you put pineapple and pepper or you put salt on watermelon. You know, you get a juxtaposition in your mind of eating something that isn't normally eaten as a savory or a sweet product.
Okay, Frank Castronova, you've got lunch. What are we serving up?
Well, that's the perfect time for the tomato and avocado salad, which Frank coined the phrase gazpacho in the mouth. It's fresh tomatoes from the garden, juicy, delicious, and sweet. Avocados, onions, salt and pepper, olive oil. There you have it.
And easy.
Yeah, we're all about easy. We're all about practical, utilitarian recipes that everybody can make. You don't need to be a four-star chef.
Yeah, if you're driving home from work right now, you could be listening to this. Think about the tomatoes, think about the onion, think about the avocado. Stop and pick it up. Go into the garden, grab the olive oil, and in 10 minutes, you and your family or your girlfriend or your wife or whatever are eating a delicious something.
So let's move on to dinner. And I guess in our ping pong tomato game, Frank Falsinelli, we're back to you.
We're serving the crab pasta. And, it's an anticipated favorite of Frank and myself and our partners, Tony and Travis and the guys. We love when the fresh crabs, the young crabs, come in the beginning of August. It's very Neapolitan that, you know, you're taking those crabs and you're just sweating it in a little bit of olive oil. You're adding the tomatoes on top. You're cooking maybe for 25, 30 minutes for a quick infusion of that delicious ocean flavor. And then you're taking the crabs out and picking the meat and cooking a fresh pound of pasta. We cook fresh pasta at the restaurant, but you can easily make it with dry pasta al dente, and then you mix it with the sauce and fresh olive oil and salt and pepper, and you're in heaven.
So how are you cooking the crab? Are you actually cooking it in the sauce, or do you cook the crab ahead of time?
We're cooking in the sauce, and as Frank always says, we cook everything in tomato sauce, and we use it in this sense as an infusion technique as opposed to the bruschetta. When we're cooking the bruschetta in there, which is a rolled up piece of pork, basically, we slow braise it for its tenderizing effect, where you wind up with a delicious pork-infused gravy.
Yeah.
You wind up with a delicious crab-infused sauce.
Yeah, the beauty of crab or any fish is that it infuses its full potential in a short period of time, whereas a meat will take a long time to really get the flavors in there. The crab is in season at the same time as the tomato, so it's natural for them to be together.
Mm. Now, Frank Castronova, you get the bonus round. Can we figure out how to serve tomatoes in a dessert?
Well, we can, actually. There's an amazing ice cream, or actually not an ice, it's a granité.
Delicious.
It's so delicious. You're basically just pureeing the tomato with water and adding some sugar, and then you're freezing that, and you're scraping it over a piece of bread. It's almost like the AM dish, but it's frozen and sweet.
Mm. Frank Falsinelli and Frank Castronova, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Frank Falsinelli and Frank Castronova are the authors of a new cookbook called The Frankie Spuntino Kitchen Companion and Cooking Manual. If you'd like to try any of the dishes they just talked about, grab your tomatoes and head to our website. You'll find recipes for tomato granite, tomato avocado salad, and spaghetti with crab. That's at npr.org.
Ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a bacon. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'll I be without homegrown?
This is NPR.